boys and girls, dying time is here.
That's right, we are still talking Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood, on Kill by Kill. Well, greetings and salutations, Internet. It's your old pal, Patrick Hamilton, coming to you once again from Camp Crystal Lake, or at least the dock that an old dead body used to be chained to the bottom of it, as close as we can possibly get anyways. And this is the Kill by Kill podcast, where we are dedicated to celebrating the least discussed component of any horror film, the characters. We will be talking about all the gory details of Friday the 13th, Part 7, in the hopes that a partier's untimely end is just the beginning of the jokes that we can make about them. And as always, there is only one person I trust to make sure that if I'm just going to do a little bit of a touch-up, honey, she's going to make it happen. The one and only Gina Radcliffe. How are you doing, Gina?
I'm good. I'm still recovering from our birthday potiversary extravaganza. I've eaten nothing but midnight snack shish kebab for the past 2 weeks now. Frankly, I'm a little tired of it. I'm ready to try something new.
I did not know the Pandora's box that we were quite opening when we started talking about shish kebabs and whether or not they are a midnight snack. There were a lot of opinions online. Get out of town. People online have opinions, specifically about shish kebabs and how long their preparation time is. And I think all the evidence leads to shish kebabs are not a fucking midnight snack, people. It's not okay. Anyways, the good news is, we are not alone for our journey to the Party of Doom. No, we have on a very special guest. She is a publisher. She's a writer. She is on Twitter with the Horror Honeys, which if you are not subscribed to, you must right now. And of course, she's also a podcast host of Carry On, the one and only Kat Wells.
Hey, how are you doing, guys. Kat? I'm wonderful. How are you?
Excellent. So much better now that you are here to help us with this muddled mess of a terrible, terrible party. Now, Kat, you are a person who I feel has a diverse array of interests. You seem to very much love true life murder mysteries.
For
right?
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
And you also have a podcast about Sex in the City.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is like true life murder.
They seem dissimilar, and they are. But, you know, I've always kind of looked at it much like the way that I look at horror podcasts or at horror movies. And from listening to your guys' episodes, I can see you feel the same way. Even though you feel an intense appreciation for them, you're not afraid to be critical. And that's kind of how we approach Sex and the City on our podcast. We love the show, but we recognize its flaws. So, you know, I like dipping a toe. I like learning about serial killers, and I love Carrie Bradshaw. So sue me.
No, I wouldn't have it any other way. The world needs more people with diverse interests. We don't need to define ourselves by one thing. And that being said, this is a podcast where we define ourselves by one thing, and that is where you first saw a Friday the 13th movie. Where in your life did you first come across it?
I have a very clear and simple answer for this. I have an older brother. He's about 6.5 years older than I am. And I'm almost positive that the very first Friday the 13th I ever saw, which continues to be my favorite sequel, was Part 6, Jason Lives. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we rented the VHS from the video store and we would watch it over and over again. I was 10 or maybe a little younger. So that was my first introduction to Jason. Was campy, meta, jokey, sex, like all the best things about the series, zombie Jason. That was my first introduction. And then of course later I saw all the rest of them.
Pouches, misogyny in the woods,
yeah.
RVs that don't catch on fire, everything.
Alice Cooper music.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Which, upon listening to the party music in our particular section of the movie for this episode, I pine for the days where our ear holes were filled to the brim with Alice Cooper and Felony, as opposed to whatever the hell is going on here.
Yeah, no kidding.
It sounds like In Excess, but on lewds they can't come up from.
Yeah, it's definitely like somebody's idea of air quote new wave air quote.
Yes, but transmuted, like they can't decide if they want to be post new wave pop that has a lot of chunky guitars, but they also kind of want to be glam and hair metal-esque. You know, a lot of Dial MTV is happening in the midst of this, and it's the worst version of Dial MTV rock ever. as a person who suffered through a great amount of Dial MTV rock, I can tell you, it was a terrible time to be alive. But infinitely better than now. Let's get back to...
Jesus, no kidding.
Okay, at the moment of this recording, the world does feel like it's falling apart, but you know what holds us to its center? That is the people who are still left alive in this movie. So let's quickly give you a body count to review who has survived so far. Let's start with Tina. Now, this isn't the Tina from Part 4, and it's not the Tina from Part 5. This is the new Tina, who looks like she's dry swallowing an Advil whenever she summons her godlike telekinetic powers. Then we have Tina's mom, Mrs. Shepherd, yet another mom not given a first name. Fun fact about Mrs. Shepherd, she was the hair model for all of the Lost Boys.
I was about to say, that's some glorious hair right there, held up probably by Aquanet, if I had to guess.
Aquanet, Dreams, a series of trusses. I'm not really sure. Everything that allows it to be as curvy and buoyant as it is. That said, like every girl in this movie has a version of the exact same hair. It seems to be a football of follicles right above the forehead and then a swooping where like someone should skateboard down the side of it along the back.
I don't think hair does that anymore. Like that, we've lost something.
Yeah, we don't have that hairstyle anymore where if someone were to rap on your head with their knuckles, it would make sound. It's that sort of solid mahogany table kind of sound, that very rich, stentorous tone of placing a heavy object on top of another heavy object.
I told my kid today, who's learning how to ride a two-wheeler, that I grew up not having to wear a bike helmet. And he's like, oh, how did you protect your head? And I said, we had very sturdy hair. And that, of course, brings us now to Dr. Bad News Cruz, who once again has been brought to the screen by Terry Kaiser. Now, we've talked a little bit about Terry Kaiser in the past, but we should note a couple of his other more notable roles. In one movie, he was a corpse that was unreported to the police so that two dudes could commit petty larceny and get laid. And then in another movie, he put Tammy's boyfriend's brain in a T-Rex. And that's all I can remember about Terry Kaiser.
He also played a corpse whose death was unreported so that two guys could continue getting into some hijinks and get laid.
But in that one, he also became a dancing zombie, which was probably the highlight of that film.
A curiously well-preserved corpse.
He's good at playing preserved corpses. Now let's get to our group of partiers. We have to start this with Nick. He's that kind of bad boy with a heart of gold and legs of a Clydesdale.
Got that Canadian tuxedo going on.
That's right. Oh my God, his hair looks like every comic book interpretation of a guy from 1994. There's just a lot of fuzz going up and two going down.
I feel like that if you looked at the actor's filmography, he would basically play variations of Brad, Chad, and Sean in very episodes of ABC After School specials. He just has that nice guy look, the sort of bland boyfriend or love interest of the heroine. He looks like he's played a lot of characters named Brad.
His hair made me think of Jake Ryan from 16 Candles.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I can really see that.
It's actually, like, I'm, and even though like if I saw a guy with hair like that today, I'd be very confused. I feel like there's something about that hair from watching 16 Candles as a kid that makes me like automatically think that person is attractive, which is counterintuitive.
It's rote at this point. Like some part of this has infested your DNA and it's culturally oh, attractive person. No, yeah. Not really. I've gotten a look at this person, what he has to say.
And how old is he supposed to be in this movie? How old are any of them? But he's like, he looks 30.
We've established that it is unclear how old these characters are supposed okay. to be. I think Tina is supposed to be maybe 18. And the people at this party range in age anywhere from 18 to 35. It's a very interesting party.
It's a key demographic.
On an anthropological level, this party is very interesting to observe because we're at the point where it seems like there's four different parties going on, and none of these people are interacting with each other very much except to occasionally glare at each other.
The only thing that holds these people together is this mysterious Michael, who we only get to meet for like 10 lines in the entire movie. So we don't know what it was about him that all these people were drawn to.
There's your spinoff.
But none of them seem to like Michael very much. This is something we'll get back into when we talk about Ben and Kate.
Concerned that he hasn't shown up, that, oh, can you believe this asshole doesn't show up for his own party? Well, maybe you should be a little worried that he's not shown up for his own party.
Well, at one point, they were talking about how they were pretty much convinced he had been pulled over for driving while intoxicated. So he doesn't have a great sort of Q rating amongst this group. And yet they've all dragged their asses up to New Jersey to party with people they do not care to hang out with at all. It's great. Oh, boy. All right. So let's get into a few more of these terrible partiers. Let's start with Eddie. Eddie is the audience surrogate.
Let's just face it.
Yes. And like all audience surrogates, he's terrible so that you should feel terrible because everyone is terrible. Audience surrogates are worse than paramedics in the world of Friday the 13th. Eddie's a nerd so devoid of personal moral turpitude that he's willingly makes fun of a young woman who recently exited a mental health facility just because a pretty girl asked him to.
The 80s, man.
Is it the 80s?
I don't know.
He's like a fuckboy. Like, I think
I kind of
hate him worse. Well, I should apologize to Shelley. We came really down really hard on Shelley when we went through part 3. And I think part of that was a direct reaction to the hellacious online torrent of dickheads talking about the Ghostbusters remake around that exact time.
Oh, yeah. And that made a lot of people angry.
For no fucking reason. Yeah. But Gina and I had had enough. And I think we took it out on Shelley.
Yeah.
I think Shelley deserves some of
Shelley
it.
A bit.
Oh.
But poor Larry Zerner, who is the nicest man on earth. He heard it. And he's like, oh, you guys really do not like Shelley.
Oh, no.
And I felt bad. I stand by a good 75% of what we said, though.
Gina? It's a terrible character, and it's not his fault. Yeah, you know, I think he might have been a little too good in the role. I think he might have had a little bit of a Michael Rooker thing, where you know, I am incapable of seeing Michael Rooker as anything but Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
But even when he's a blue fin alien,
I just cannot see him as anything else but dropping a television on someone's head. I cannot. I don't know how this man has maintained being married and having children or being in the same room with anybody else. But yeah, I mean, it's a credit to Larry Zerner that he was that convincing playing a terrible human being.
It's true.
Sure, and isn't it more fun to watch these movies when you absolutely hate seeing someone get killed, or hate the person, so it's like a lot of fun to see them get what's coming to them?
I think that is the grand debate of this podcast in total. Whether or not it's better to like the people who are the cast of characters, or it is better to hate them.
Sure.
I think there's a debate to be had. I don't think there's a right answer, and I don't think there's a wrong answer. But I'll tell you right now, if part 5 is the example of a group of people you hate, and that's why you enjoy watching it,
Yeah, no, they tried that and it didn't work, and I could spend a lot of time autopsying why it didn't work, but I don't know that I'll ever be able to come to a solution, because the people in this movie aren't terribly likable, like, with the possible exception of Tina and Nick, and yet it was a far more enjoyable movie.
Well, I think it's accomplished with more joie de vivre. That being said, let's rounding the corner here. We just have two more. The first one's Robin, who's a complete turd to her friend for no fucking reason, other than she is desperate to have sex with a stoner slob
who compliments David, her by saying, "You hardly sweat at all."
I think that's my favorite line in this entire movie. I think it is the best written line. It is the best delivered line. It is the stupidest compliment, and maybe the best.
She's just melting over it. I mean, within minutes, they're in the sack.
Yes, that is the gateway to her heart. It's like the thing she's always wanted to hear. But I think the thing she always wanted to hear was, "I want to sleep with you," and then that's all it took. I'm not shaming her for having a desire to catch some dick. That's more power to her. I think she can do better than David, but then again, the way she treats her friends, maybe she can't. I don't know. And then, of course, that brings us to Melissa, who may be less of a human being and more of a golem constructed of MAC cosmetics in order to terrorize a very small village that is completely made up of these two cabins
in
this movie.
She's very Machiavellian, but in a clumsy and obvious way. Like, I do think it's funny that she attempts to hit on Nick. He's not having it. He says, "I don't like you." She says, "Like has nothing to do with it." And then walks over to the other guy and starts flirting with him.
She's obviously under the belief this will make him jealous. But he's pretty much told you, "I don't like you at all." And she's like, hasn't stopped anybody else. Maybe it should have.
Yeah, she's got moxie, this one.
Moxie, or she's a psychopath. Yeah. I can't really determine. It's one or the other. But she may be, this may be the ground zero of he's almost literally
she
does not
that.
Pick up on that signal. It's hard to seduce people when they're calling to check up on their dead cousins. This is not the time where people feel at their sexiest when they want to make a move.
He is calling his cousin, and he's doing the whole, "Come on, pick up. And then when Melissa enters the kitchen, he says, "Well, I'm just going to walk around looking in the woods for him." Who is he talking to?
I don't know. This entire sequence of the movie that we're going to be discussing sees not one, not two, not three, not four, but five separate people just wander into the fucking woods. Like, maybe Tina has the best excuse, which is, "I'm going to run this Delta 88 off the road, and now I gotta walk somewhere." But she's the only one with a decent excuse. Everyone else is like, "Okay, I don't know what to do now." And the script says,
wander
in the woods.
If you are awaiting
sounds good enough to me.
You're someone to arrive at a party and they have not arrived, it would seem to me that the logical conclusion one would make on how to find them would be, well, I don't know, calling the local constabulary? Maybe the hospital? I mean, I realize the hospital at Crystal Lake is pretty busy. But you could probably call it and say, "Hey, has a guy named Michael whatever been brought into the emergency room?" No, he's just going to wander around and just try to, in woods he's not familiar with, as we've established that all these people have come out of town. And he's just going to wander around trying to find this person, driven into a ditch? What does he expect
to find?
Yeah,
maybe they've fallen over.
I feel like the way that I've justified this for myself is, after all these years, I mean, this movie opens with, like, the line, you know, like, "There's a legend around here," or whatever, the beautiful voiceover. That's so fun. And I feel like, and that sounded sarcastic, but it wasn't. I actually love it. But you know, I feel like after all of these years of this, like, nasty energy and, like, zombie zombie Jason and, you know, all this stuff. And this is like the paranormal sequel of this series. And it's like, and maybe there's this like psychic energy that's just drawing them out into the woods to die, because Jason's just like a tornado of like death and destruction. And he's just got a lot. I mean, he's very powerful in this movie. Anyway, I don't know. That's the justification I came to in my brain.
There is a weird sequence in which he just walks up to the window where everybody's partying, stands there for a minute, and then walks away. And then that's when everybody decides, well, I think I'm just going to take a little stroll in these woods in the dark of night in a town I've never been to before. That's actually, I actually like that theory. I don't know if that's actually what they were going for, but I do like that theory.
I'm sure it wasn't.
Puts a spookier sort of edge on it.
Yeah, she's at the very least, Tina has awakened something. I mean, she's awakened Jason himself through her powers, so maybe she's awakened just, like, all the bad juju that's, like, seeped into the ground at this damn lake.
If the place does, in fact, have a death curse, as Crazy Ralph has so put it, and he's a sage enough man, he's stared in enough windows staring at people having sex to know some things about this town.
Yeah.
And if it does in fact have this random death curse that just makes people do stupid things, a la Cabin in the Woods, I actually kind of love this theory, because we have really entered into super supernatural areas. Whereas in part 6, it was a monster movie. He was Frankenstein. He's risen by lightning. He's drowned in a lake. Now he's been risen by this telekinetic psychic power. So we're into some weirder territory here, and I actually like it. The one other thing I want to state about Jason coming and looking at people through that window is that if you listen to it carefully, you can hear him breathing. And I don't think that's fucking possible. I don't think a person who has been living underneath a lake is breathing hard, looking at people through a window.
When she resurrects him, he's like bubble. There's bubbles coming up from the, and you can see him underwater, like breathing out bubbles. I had the same thought. I was like, has this fucker been holding lungs full of air for 10 years? Like, what the hell?
Yeah, I call bullshit on this one. This is where I draw the line. I just don't like. I guess his lungs are coming in and out as some sort of autonomic regularity, like it's muscle memory or something.
I don't want to hear panty, whatever you want to call it, when he's coming up on Ben and Kate's van too.
Listen, the air is thick with
there's like a well-timed triple bone going on in that sequence. I think that might be one time we've gotten, well, okay, one of them didn't go full boning, but still, I mean, that was also did you guys put this on some sort of itinerary for the party? It's like, okay, 10:30 to 11:30, we boning.
Bone zone.
We boning, ladies and gentlemen. I think we've found our hashtag to possibly rival. Yeah, everyone's looking to get bunked, and yet, does anyone really? So much weird sex. Let's rewind back to this party, because there's many details to talk about. First of all, space mummy, I'm not buying that pitch. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, that's your bread and butter. You know about pitching, and space mummy's not going to make it in this competitive entertainment industry?
In this market, space mummy ain't going to land you on the blacklist. I can tell you right fucking now. That's not IP that I'm getting down with. Secondly, well, we've already discussed you hardly sweat at all. But the nice thing about You Hardly Sweat at All is that is the straw that breaks little Maddie Dublin's back. She's sick of this. She wanted to have unsatisfying sex with that stoner. And there is her girlfriend almost totally ready and lined up for the get bunked-a-thon that's about to go down. And so she storms off and heads upstairs, looks herself in the mirror, starts manhandling various beauty products, almost does her nails, and then decides, nope, I'm going to do lipstick first. Wait, before I put something on my face, I'm going to take my glasses off so I can't see anything.
It's a very 80s movie, I would say, this one, and part six are very much playing into the 80s pop culture. So of course, naturally, it's inevitable that there would be a makeover scene in a movie that absolutely does not warrant one. Not that any movie really warrants a makeover scene. I mean, I could start a whole separate podcast about my strong dislike for makeover scenes, but this one especially, it's just such a weird moment that this is this character's, you know, I'm gonna go and get my man and go through all the trouble of putting on what appears to be a dress with no pants and a lot of makeup that ultimately makes her look about 30 when before she looked like she was about 17 or 18.
Why is being fancy to women in this movie and really the 80s in general? It's like they're working for Trask Industries or something. Like, it's working girl. Like, what's happening? Why is looking
it's a
sexy
very hard
looking
look.
Like your mom?
She kind of looks like she was she should have been in the in heavy metal parking lot afterwards.
Well, as we stated in the last episode, she's having her own ZZ Top lady transformation. Where she goes from just working in the shoe shop to then putting on high heels. And oh my God, guys, that lady's got legs. And then people throw their milkshakes up in the air. They just can't believe it.
The other thing that bothered me is, I forget the line, but someone, that bitch tells her, you know, you need a little upgrade or whatever.
Yes.
And then she gives herself a little upgrade and then says, a little upgrade my ass. It's like, yeah, no, but you just did that.
Yeah.
And you seem happy about it, so maybe your friend just gave you some good advice? I don't know.
It's she's falling into the trap. Like, she's like, how dare you tell me something that I need to do? I'm going to go do it.
That'll show you.
Yeah. Take that. Stick that where the sun don't shine. I just did what you told me to do. I got upset about. So she takes off her glasses and cue sixpence none the richer.
Oh, God.
I guess. That outfit is confounding.
The white heels I really identify with from my childhood because all of my Barbies had, like, white heels because that's when I had Barbies was when white pumps were, like, a thing. Mm-hmm. So I was like, yeah, makes sense to me. And then I was wait a minute, that's terrible. Those are terrible
shoes.
She's
wearing, like, a men's shirt without pants at first. And then later, I'm like, oh, no, it's just a weird crop top and a skirt that is also troublingly short.
It seems to be belted into that chunky white belt up until the point Russell's body falls out of the sky, and then she pulls it out when she screams upward, and then I'm like, oh, I thought that was like a one piece to do, and it's actually two separate unattractive pieces of clothing married together by a chunky belt. So here's my big question here. Okay. This leads, we're now pulling the thread all the way through. This party is going on. She goes upstairs. We have this miraculous transformation. She has legs and she comes out, right? But she does not go down the stairs to the party. She goes out some separate entrance to try to find this guy she wants to seduce.
I was thinking, did we miss a scene where she saw them go outside?
Why isn't there a scene of her going downstairs and saying, guys, guys? And it's all empty. And later it's explained where they've all gone. They've all gone upstairs to, you know. And she just missed them. This would be fine. That would be filmmaking. That would tell me what the fuck is going on. But no, she just emerges out of the door. And she's like, hello? Why
going
would they
back
be
to that, that psychic bubble that's drawing people out into the merciless woods of Crystal Lake.
Yes,
that's
very
right.
True.
And but for a loose earring, maybe she would have just called out, not heard from anyone, and gone
back
to
inside. Find that,
but
that
no.
Missing no. Claire's earring that probably cost about $250, and she's carrying on like it was you know, a diamond teardrop hanging from her ear.
Yes. Thank everyone, God she found that clip-on down in the leaves.
Why is everyone in this movie so concerned with their fucking jewelry? Why is it this movie where everyone's like, my necklace, my earring?
My beautiful pearls.
Like they had to sign it out from some sort of jeweler before they went to set. I don't quite get it, but she does actually recover that earring, which I find impossible, as she has heels on in the woods.
Glasses. She wears movie glasses. It's a fucking miracle. You need right them until there. You don't need them anymore.
Oh, that makes sense. The other thing I sort of noticed in this section, this is part of the music in this movie is terrible. Unlike every movie that has come before, this is the worst Friday the 13th music of all time. At one point in the sequence, it has seagull noises. They're not at the beach. What the fuck is happening? And it's also doubling up on that. Until it's like if it broke out into a Stevie Wonder song, I'd be like, yeah, I can see that mashup. You don't double up on the kill kamamamas. Come on, man.
I have to wonder if there's some story behind the seagulls. I was just reading this story about how apparently one of the Backstreet Boys farted while they were recording a famous song of theirs, and the fart made it into the track, and it was like a really famous song. And I'm like, you know, and they the whole story involved like their producer like being like, it's gonna be a hit, we're keeping it in. So maybe the seagulls were maybe a rogue seagull wandered onto set, and they were like, we gotta leave it in.
This is perfect. This movie is the fart in the sound booth. Of Friday the 13th movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Magic is in the air. And it came from that dude's butt. So, yeah, Maddie slowly starts to realize, this is a dumb idea. I got to get out of here. It feels very creepy. There are mystery ghost seagulls. And then Russell's body just falls from the sky. And yet another example of Jason Voorhees interior / exterior decorator, but this gag doesn't work so well, or maybe it works perfectly. His body thumps to the ground. She freaks out and immediately heads towards a tool shed.
Ugh.
Yeah, she's maybe what, about 20-50 feet away from the house.
Yes. No, she this is again people have caught Friday the 13th disease. Things they knew how to do before, like walk into a house. They get confused, and they go, oh, walk into tool shed.
I'm beginning at this point to think that Jason Voorhees read The Secret and, like, has been, like, bringing good vibes to himself. Because not only are all these teenagers just, like, they come resurrect his ass from the water, and then they're just all there for the picking. But now one of them wanders into a tool shed, and he gets to come in and be like, which fucking terrifying implement will I employ to fuck shit up? Like, no one's ever been so lucky. No serial killer has ever had so much, you know, good fortune as Jason in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, everybody in this movie just you know, folds in his presence immediately. I mean, she runs into a shed with, I'm pretty sure there's an axe and some sort of spiked thing, and then the scythe that he eventually uses. She doesn't even look. She just runs behind this flimsy wall and just breathes and sobs as loud as she possibly can.
It's so loud.
While refusing to let go of her $20 Contempo casual shoes.
Yeah, I don't know if she's trying to pull a sort of Atomic Blonde maneuver where she's going to stab somebody with her heel, but that heel's a little too chunky for that. I think you might get a nice contusion, but you're not going to get penetration. Sorry, Maddie.
That's what he said.
That's right. That is exactly what he said. This is when we get a nice Jason Voorhees likes to break through things. But this time, just his hands. That's all he needs. And he managed to bust through this thing while holding a scythe because he's got the Voorhees family forearms and he can hold on to anything. And so that's it. R.I.P.D. Maddie Dumplin'. You deserve better.
We hardly knew ye.
we hardly knew any of these people.
Yeah, I don't think that they'll be missed. I've been watching this movie in sections, and every time I've forgotten their names anew.
But in particular, the Crystal Lake Gazette would probably state for this, like, massacre, 9 bodies found, world a better place.
Nothing of value was lost.
We're all okay. It worked out for the best. I don't know if that's journalism, but, you know, maybe that's why I'm not a journalist. So let's then rewind just a tad, because there's a couple things that happen in here that should be discussed. One is that Mrs. Shepherd, whose hair is like a beautiful sphinx, finds this mass of paperwork and recordings that are queued up to just the right moment for her.
Of course.
So that she can discover that Dr. Bad News is not trying to help her daughter at all. He's trying to make her into a crazier person so that, as Nick White said on his episode, he can finally get her on late 80s Oprah for an episode. And that's when the money just starts piling in. And she, of course, takes umbrage to this, and he fiddles with the sleeve of his sweater a lot, like he's winding a watch. Well, I don't know what's going on here.
You missed the part where whose body did he discover?
Well, he didn't. Oh, he discovers Michael's body.
Right. And he finds the tent spike, and the way he reacts in this scene is so inexplicable. He picks up the tent spike, and of course, I'm thinking, you shouldn't pick that up. Your fingerprints are going to be all over that. And he slowly walks towards the body in a way that one is supposed to comprehend as sinister, I guess. And then he drops it like he just took a pan of biscuits out of the oven. and then it holds his hand like he's been burned. And I'm like, okay, what just happened here? Did he suddenly remember, oh, I probably shouldn't be picking up this weapon that was used to presumably murder this human being whose body I've just found?
But Gina, you know how Crystal Lake CSI works. Like, they're going to check for fingerprints. They just grab it with their bare hands and put it in a plastic bag.
Exactly. And then he spends the rest of the scene up through talking to Mrs. Shepherd, just rubbing his hand. And I'm like, what is the audience supposed to take? I mean, we know it's not him doing this. So I'm not sure why the movie suddenly does this weird left-hand turn into implying that he's even more sinister than he actually is. He's plenty sinister enough. You don't have to have some weird subplot. Well, maybe it's him that's doing this. No, we know it's not him.
Does he think that Tina's doing it? Does he think that Tina somehow mentally, because he knows that Tina can make a TV move wobbly on one string. Does he think that Tina can shoot out a tent spike and gut a guy and put him in a tree?
I don't think,
because he doesn't know anything of Jason Voorhees at all.
I don't think that how he wouldn't. I have no idea, because you would think this would make the national news at some point. I mean, I realize this is a pre-internet era that this movie takes place in, but generally speaking, serial killers were you know, they made national news.
Yeah, yeah. People knew about Ted Bundy.
Yeah, I mean,
and yet they still got into VWs.
He was up to like 75 victims at this point. I would think that the name Jason Voorhees would be somewhat, you know, familiar to the American public at that point. But I feel like he is dodging around. I mean, he's getting ready to leave, but doesn't want to tell her, oh, yeah, there's a corpse outside. We should probably go.
That's somebody else's problem. People get murdered, I guess, is what comes down to. He's much more focused on just tamping down any sort of objections that Mrs. Shepherd has to this process and telling her in no uncertain terms, I'm committing your daughter above and beyond any of your objections, so just let me do that. And she's like, yeah, fuck that. So Mrs. Shepherd's all right in my book.
Oh, yeah. She calls him a fucking coward later, which is like, it was really satisfying.
When Mom yells at Dr. Bad News, it sounds like an elf who's trying to get wolves away from Santa's workshop. So Tina ends up taking off in that Delta 88 and driving it off the road. And
in a very unspectacular crash. And of course, that car is fine because it is made of reinforced steel and it is death. So she just wanders off into the forest where she ends up running into Nick out. And she's like, I got things to do, and runs off in the other direction. Like, why is everyone wandering in this forest? So that's that subplot. Then we have to go back and talk about the other two characters that are under our purview for this particular episode. And that is Ben and Kate. Not the Ben of Kate of the Fox show. A completely different Ben and Kate. And they are very mad at one another for the majority of the time that they're on screen. Up until the point they're not. We're never told why they're upset with one another. Any guesses?
He made comments about the fact that she's dressed like the neighbor from Small Wonder.
It's a cosplay. It's cosplay.
She's got those acid wash overalls on. That was a good Luke, as the kids say.
maybe she's mad that he never takes her out to the back of a van for a really romantic sex romp.
She might be mad that he never takes his pants off when they have sex.
I noticed that too.
He doesn't take his pants off. He not only that, I don't think he took his shoes off.
Yeah, he definitely hopped out of the van with shoes on.
Now, I'm not going to ask any of you ladies for any sort of sex experience in the past in which a man has kept his shoes on. But from my perspective, I will come out and tell you right now, unless I am having sex in the outdoors of itself, I take my shoes off. That's the least I can do.
Oh, I can't even tolerate leaving socks on.
Oh,
maybe if it's like, you know, very cold, if you're out camping somewhere, but you know, if you don't take the socks off, you can fuck right off with that. I feel very, very strongly. I blame Fast Times at Ridgemont High because I associate leaving one socks on during sex with Mike Damone.
Oh my God, you are giving me a moment right now. I was like, where have I seen that image in my nightmares? No, Fast Times.
The biggest scumbag in 80s teen pop culture left his socks on during sex, and I cannot disassociate it with that.
What a piece of shit.
Gina Radcliffe, ladies and gentlemen. That's right.
She has things.
Bow the fuck
down. She has things to say.
I approve of that rant. I wholeheartedly.
So if you were an asshole for leaving your socks on during sex, imagine pants and shoes. And whenever it cuts back, they have another piece of clothing on. It's like clothing spontaneously combusts onto their body. It's like it's their mutant power. But back during the party when they reconcile from the fight that we know nothing about, she looks at him and says the strangest goddamn thing I've ever heard, which is, I love you, squid face.
Is that what she said? I know she called him something. It's like, did she call him squid face? Or
I turned on the closed captions so that I could be certain.
Wow.
That is not... Is that a pet name that you have given him? Also, he implores her to hit him, and then at one point she does, which makes me think that's part of their sex play.
It's the... So, squid face, pants and shoes on, light slapping. I mean, don't kink shame, Patrick.
Oh, I'm not yucking their yum at all. I'm just trying to get to the nut of the problem here.
Yucking their yum. I'm putting that in my back pocket.
Oh, listen, kids on the internet, they'll tell you almost anything. that's not mine. So they end up, getting back together. And during the hour of boner power that this particular cabin has, where everyone goes, all right, we all have sexual partners, break. And they go off to their separate corners. Ben and Kate decide, hey, that van that our friends used for sex the other day, let's use that van.
Which is decorated with birthday party decorations, which made me wonder, were they going to have the party in the van at some point?
Yeah, why didn't they take all the decorations out?
I mean, you could have more vivid, you know, really done up those two hockey sticks that are in there with more decorations than they already did. Why leave it in the van? Swing for the fences, party decorators. That's what I have to say.
I'm honestly really thankful that they all dispersed to, like, separate private places to have sex, because I just rewatched Chopping Mall, where all of the couples are just having sex in the same room.
Yes, that takes, that just has an energy I'm not okay with. Again, if that's your thing, I'm not saying it's wrong and I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying I don't want to buy any of that furniture, and I also do not want to be part of your sex party. There has been on occasion in my life here, living in Los Angeles, a town I was born and bred in, that I have wandered into a situation where I begin to wonder, is group sex about to happen here? And then it never does. And I always feel weird about it, but then I'm like, I don't know. That's like my spidey sense. Is group sex about to happen here? And then it doesn't. So I definitely know when group sex is not going to happen.
Wow, that's like Karen in Mean Girls saying her boobs know when it's raining.
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty
my
much.
My boobs know when it's raining, non-group sex.
Well, that's pretty good, though, because that'll actually prevent you from being in any, like, awkward, like, ice storm type of situations.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, there's, yeah, okay, I'm going to shut up now. Okay.
No, please, go on.
No. People in my neighborhood know where I live. All right. So, yeah, they decide, let's go have sex in that van. And Russell's having sex with his shoes on. The van begins a rocking of no fault of their own. It's rocking from an external force. And once again, a terrible thing is attributed to the friend that they're all there to go see. Michael. Michael's the kind of person who would shove a van you're having sex in. It sounds like a great guy.
They immediately assume that he's just, if the van is a rockin', Michael's gonna come a knockin'.
Yes. He's that kind of person. So why the fuck are you hauling your ass up to New Jersey to celebrate this asshole? He sounds like a real dick.
He drinks and drives, and he interrupts you when you're having sex.
And apparently he is known for just not showing up for things.
Yeah. Why wouldn't you go out of your way for his birthday party? So at this point, Ben becomes preoccupied with the idea of, quote-unquote, getting Michael. Now, Michael knows you exist. Michael knows you're in that van, according to you. I don't know how you're going to get Michael, but he does. He bamfs clothes onto his body, and so does she, and he wanders outside, much to her chagrin. And he does a full 360 around the van for the most part.
Tooting on that party horn.
Yes. That's not how you sneak up on people. Tooting horns. We now have Friday the 13th disease striking people when they're sneaking up on others. They're tooting horns like you do.
You've got a horn, you've got to toot it. That's just the way the world works. I don't know.
It's the way this world works, unfortunately. And as a result of this, he gets crushed vertically. His skull gets crushed vertically, I guess, by Jason. Is that what they're going for, Gina?
Yeah. Again, we've talked about how the last couple of movies have been fairly bloodless in their kills. Yes, I think he just kind of, you know, did a little, you know, grape squishing of his head.
Yeah, it's a different angle than he's used to. He's usually going for that vice-like grip here. And this one, he goes up top and up bottom, which is a very awkward grip.
It is, but you know, he figures if he doesn't challenge himself sometimes, he'll never, it's all about gains, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, he's still testing out that super strength that he gained in part six.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't get as many, oh shit, I can do that looks from him in this movie, but he's definitely, he remembers that. Yeah.
We get more, oh shit, she can do that looks.
That's right.
Yeah.
We get a lot of astonishment later on in this movie.
It's fun. It's pretty fun.
Oh, I have stated that I actually like this movie. I don't believe it to be a good movie, but I do like it. I think it's funnish.
I re-listened to the Boys and Ghouls episode we did a two-parter on the whole series. And I was like, I remember not feeling great about this movie. And I re-listened to it and I used the H word. I said I hated it. Ooh. And I know. And then I rewatched it today and loved every fucking second of it. So I guess that's a good argument for rewatching. I need to just go rewatch like Rob Zombie's Halloween right now. Maybe I'll love it.
Oh, no. You don't have to do that.
You're right.
You gained something today.
I did.
Take it away.
You're right.
So quickly.
You're pulling me back from the ledge. Pull me back. I need to calm down. This movie is so fun. I actually felt like it was like competently directed. I thought a lot of the shots were really creative. All the kills were really fun. I actually liked some of the characters. Like, I don't even know what's come over me, but this is now moved farther up the list than I ever thought it would for me. So.
Yeah.
Ugh, I owe you that. Anyway.
So we have a head crushing, so RIPD Ben, and then very quickly, this is when Kate decides, well, I gotta stick my head out of this window and figure out what's doing. Because while she's put on every other ounce of clothing she hasn't put on her pants or those acid wash overalls, actually, that we know that she possesses. She sticks her head out the window. And then Jason shoves a party horn through her eye.
I love this death. I love it. I think it is probably one of the most creative ones in the whole series.
You get a little honk when he does it.
He's making do with what he has on hand. I don't know what he did with the scythe after killing Maddie, but you would think, I mean, that's kind of a badass weapon. You think he'd hold on to that for a while, like with the machete. But I guess he was like, meh, I can't put this in my pocket. I'll find something else.
That's right. Well, he's got, as Jason Bromley pointed out, he has a very Jackie Chan-like idea of just using what's around to accomplish what he needs to do.
That's pretty smart.
Yeah. And so, Kate, you had pretty spectacular hair, and you had very unfortunate overalls. I'm sorry, you're dead. So that pretty much wraps up this section of the movie. And as always, that means it's time for America's least known game show, Choose Your Own Death Venture. And that is where we decide of the deaths that we have discussed in this particular episode. If we were forced to die that way, which we would choose and why. And as our guest, Kat, I turn to you first for your answer.
Well, I've been thinking about this since you brought it up at the beginning of this episode. I have my answer. I feel like I'm going with the horn, the party horn to the eye, because I feel like she has less time to, A, to suffer, B, to anticipate the death, versus the head crushing. That's a long, drawn out, painful thing until you're dead. Maddie, she's a shaking leaf of a frightened little like drowned rat. Like she has time to like be petrified and know that her ass is about to die. And I don't want that. No, I want it in the sense of like, I'm gonna go to a haunted house this year and have a really good time being scared. But if I'm actually gonna die, I don't want lead up. I want to just be dead before I know it. So I choose party horn to the eye.
That's a reasonable argument. Now you're gonna have to wear those overalls at some point.
Oh yeah. Well, those are like totally in right now. So
that's true. Yeah, you're gonna look very, very cute when you go to Cinespia in that outfit.
That's right.
I've just put that on you.
And I'm going to wear like John Lennon's like super, super circular glasses. I'll wear my sunglasses at night with my acid washed overalls and it'll be amazing.
I don't know why everyone in this town has decided that wearing a Children of the Corn hat is acceptable. But everyone has.
Wow.
So that's a little insight
it's
to
true.
What it's like in L.A. in the late summer of 2017. So, Gina, you had to suffer through that. How are you going to make us, what say you about your death?
I, too, choose the party horn to the eye. I've known that for weeks and weeks as we lead up to this. But more for a more simpler reason, it's just festive. I think it's a... It's a fun way to be found with just a party horn just sticking out of your head at a jaunty angle. I hope they leave it in when they bury me.
You know, crime CSI guys, like crime scene people, like, you know, they have really rough jobs. So the least you could do is offer them a chuckle on a Monday, you know?
Exactly. The only way that could make it better is if they put one of those paper things that you blow on and it, you know, kind of just, you know, kind of unrolls itself. If they could just put one of those just kind of hanging out of my mouth. Just you know, I want to be remembered as a fun gal, a good time person.
There's no way to do that than to be found dead with a party horn in your face.
Exactly.
Yeah. Three for three. There's no better death in this sequence than the party horn through the eye. And the fact that it gives a little honk when it happens is the best piece of ADR in the entire movie. That and hearing Jason squish when he walks, which I kind of like. He's like a maggot sponge.
Ew. Nice. Oh, God.
Well, before he was just dry, and now he's been marinating in Crystal Lake, so everywhere he goes, he's just dripping.
Mm.
And people can't seem to smell him, which Gene and I have found odd now. This is the sixth movie we've discussed with him, and how people do not smell him coming from a mile away is baffling.
I never thought about that. He probably smells absolutely gnarly.
Yeah, and yet he's able to sneak under people's beds and bunk them. No one has a problem with this whatsoever. He's a smelly man. We all have to confront this. He's that one guy you knew who's like, oh, I don't believe in antiperspirant. I'm natural. And you're like, okay,
it's
dude.
It's the pheromones. You know, the ladies love it.
Oh, pheromones. Man, dudes love to name check pheromones where you're like, yeah, you need to take a shower. So that pretty much does it, unfortunately, for this episode. But that leaves us with good news, and that's to find plugs where people can find out more about you. Kat, where can people hear and see and read from you?
I would say just come find me on Twitter and say hi. There's a really annoying story about why there's an underscore in my name, and I don't want to go into it. It'll make me very angry. So you're going to find me at underscore All Hallows Cat, like All Hallows Eve, but with K-A-T at the end. That's just find me there. Find me there, and then we'll talk forever.
There we go. Hey, Gina, where can people find you on the internet?
I write about 70s and 80s television at tuneintonight.wordpress.com.
That's right, people. Check it out today. Don't delay. Hey, you know, if you want to reach out to us here at the Kill by Kill Pod, there's a couple interesting ways to do it. You could, on Twitter, at Kill by Kill Pod, or have something longer to say than 140 characters, email us, killbykillpod@gmail.com, Instagram, at Kill by Kill Podcast. We do fun things there. That's pretty much it. If you wouldn't mind rating and reviewing us with 5 stars on iTunes, if you like the show or even love it. We greatly appreciate it. Tell us what your favorite kill is in the Friday the 13th series. If you do that, we will read it on the air to you. That's our solemn promise to you, our faithful listener. And so that brings us to an end. But don't worry, friends. The body count continues next time. And so for myself and for Kat, and for Gina. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Kill by Kill is produced by We Write Good and is intended for entertainment purposes only. Friday the 13th is owned by Paramount Pictures. Jason is owned by New Line Cinema. No infringement is intended. Kill by Kill logo was designed by Josh Hollis. Visit him at joshhollis.com. The Kill by Kill theme was created exclusively for us by Revenge Body. Get the whole track and much, much more at revengebodymemphis.bandcamp.com today.